So I tell you, the state I was in after Paddy's Day, Saturday, videos of Alexa. And
yeah.
So I was dying with a fucking hangover. And Siobhan, the kids were in school, like, so Siobhan got the kids ready for school and was obviously running around, going out here, and then Emma wanted her scooter. So the long and the short of it is they left the back door wide open. Siobhan was going out for a coffee with someone. And I'm lying in bed and heard a cat come in and just heard the pitter patter of feline feet, nothing new. Fucking look down, it wasn't one of our cats. Now, I do know the cat.
That's a friendly cat.
We call it, it looks like Spuddy, so we call it Fake Spuddy, or I do. But yeah, and then our real cat came in and spotted him and fucking ran him out the kitchen, running up and down the stairs and all. Ran into the attic first and then realised he couldn't get out that way, so come back down past me. And I'm like dying, I'm fucking in bits as well with sciatica. At the moment. So, fucking... We're recording, by the way. Welcome to Drunk Allowance, an Urban Welsh podcast. We're doing it. Yes, listeners, I had a bad experience.
Battle of the Pussies on St. Patrick's Day.
I wouldn't mind, like, bad enough having a hangover, but my arse is literally killing me at the moment. So, it's, you know what sciatica is?
Yeah, you get bummed.
Well, not in the Urban Welsh way, thank God.
Yeah,
an old disc slipped at the bottom, just above the coccyx.
Yeah, it's excruciating.
It's pushing off a nerve, and I'm in fucking bits with it. But the good news is that the doctor supplied me with some anti-inflammatories and painkillers and whatnot. So.
You won't be able to do the old Bob Senior job now, will you?
A little bit too relaxed in most muscles. But I suppose it adds to the effect of the old book. I mean, we're not doing ecstasy here, but we're on the drink again. Yeah, we're doing the drink. I mean, we discovered on the advice of Martin that this podcast is best served with alcohol. You kind of knew that already.
From the get-go, I was on board.
But I'm on board with that as well. Now I've got my prescription drugs, so that's as close legally as I like to get to ecstasy these days, you know?
I'm on crystal meth as well.
So we just need to imagine that we're sitting here, you know, the dealer has been, he sorted us out with some good shit. We've smeared ourselves in Vicks vapor rub.
I thought you were going to say something else there.
And we're going to dance, as Lionel Richie said, all night long.
So, on the ceiling.
Oh, I'm also, I literally started today, as luck would have it, on CBD oil.
Oh,
yeah,
nice.
So I got an hour delivery. Stuff. Well, what do you mean by the real stuff? The real stuff would be stuff you get off some of our friends. But no, I don't know much about the shit, but that was one of the, when I was self-diagnosing on Google, CBD oil apparently helps with sciatica, so that's why I'm after getting it.
Any good?
Well, I only took it today, so I don't know. And I'm already off my tits on prescription drugs. And now Corona.
So now you're going to say yes, it works a treat.
Corona Extra. Our unofficial sponsor. No, they're definitely not. Actually, that reminds me. We do have an unofficial sponsor. More of a spiritual sponsor, because no money has changed hands whatsoever.
As of yet.
But he did ask us to give him a shout out. So it's hello to our good friends at Trevor Garrity Heating and Plumbing.
I'm telling you, he'll fix your pipes.
He definitely will. What's that warm sensation all over your body?
That's Trevor.
Trevor's... Trevor's been in and serviced your boiler. Mmm, lovely.
He does like a bit of meddling with a boiler, all right.
He does. He only operates though in the North Kildare area, so if any of our listeners in...
Well, I'd say it's more northeast. He doesn't like going
northeast. Okay. He doesn't like going into the west side.
No. He wouldn't go out to Edenderry or...
I can't blame
him. Fairness, yeah,
I don't think we have any listeners in Edenderry, but we do have listeners in Africa. So I just want to point out to them that if Trevor was to go out there, it'd be a substantial call-out fee.
But worth it.
Yeah, and plus he can't travel at the moment. But once he can, if you want him, he'll be there.
He'll be there within an hour.
You can't imagine people in Africa need much done with their boilers, though. It's pretty nice over there all year round.
Not what Gerald's offering, anyway.
Anyway, shall we get on with the book?
Ah, we certainly should.
Let's do it. The backstory of the book. So this was actually the first Welsh book, Gem, that I remember being released, you know, after the success of Trainspotting. So in that, it's the first book I remember literally rushing out to the bookstore to buy.
Something I've never done in my life.
No, fair enough. But there was a big buzz about it, obviously, because of that, and a big demand. It apparently sold 100,000 copies in advance.
Fuck's sake.
And I'm sure Irvin himself got a hefty advance to write it.
I'd say he got a few bob out of it, all right.
But soon after publication, the book was adapted for the stage by a Canadian playwright, Keith Wyatt. No relation to Bray.
The town?
No, the wrestler.
Oh, sorry.
But yeah, probably no relation to the town of Bray either.
Just for our African listeners, that's a town in North Wicklow.
A lovely seaside resort. Not unlike the one you've seen in Baywatch. But the play debuted at the Edmonton Fringe Festival in 1998, and it was considered to be a tremendous hit, leading to a subsequent tour across Canada and at the Edinburgh Film Festival. It was attended by the story's original author himself, Irvin, whose appreciation for the play led to its international publication in an omnibus of Irvin Welsh plays entitled Foreplay. I have seen that. I haven't read it yet. Oh. I'm sure it's on your to-do list as
definitely
well.
Definitely is. It's a long list, but I'll get through it.
Indeed. Irvin said of the play, "I feel that ecstasy by Raven Productions." Was that a fart or just you moving your chair?
That's just moving the chair. Don't worry, there's plenty of farts.
I'm sure.
Bit of a dicky tummy.
"I feel that Ecstasy by Raven Productions has been the best theatrical adaptation of my work to date, and I've seen some different productions from all over the world. I feel that it fully realised the potential of the story, The Undefeated, giving it the text a power which I felt it lacked on the page." I think we possibly agree with him there.
Yeah.
"It fully captured the spirit that I intended, and in its control of pace and use of environment, it created a unique theatrical experience." Jeez, he said a lot about this, in fairness.
I've enjoyed it.
But yeah, I remember going in to buy this book. I still remember, you know, when you used to go shopping on a Saturday morning, long before the days of Amazon.
Oh, them were the days.
And I remember reading this book on the old back of the bus on the way home and thinking I was cool as shit.
But you weren't.
Yes, indeed. How wrong was I?
We were never cool, ever.
Someone at the door there. I'll let somebody else get it. So that last story was, as I say, The Undefeated, and it was the inspiration for a full-length film, which was released as Irvin Welsh's Ecstasy.
Mm.
That's possibly false advertising as well. That came out in 2011, and we will cover it possibly on our next episode.
I'm looking forward to that.
The American rock band My Chemical Romance. You've heard of them?
I have.
They're pretty rubbish, in fairness.
They're shite, but they're touring again next year.
Are they? Good luck to them.
They came back together.
Yeah. I won't be going to see them. But,
no, me neither.
Basically, they got their name from this book.
Did they?
Yeah. Three Tales of Chemical Romance. Probably that part.
Jesus.
This was published in 19...
That might explain why they're so shite. No, I don't mean that at all.
This was published by our good friend Jonathan Cape in 1996. The book cover, you have it there in front of you, Jem.
Yeah.
It's a bald man. He's blue. He looks a bit like...
like one of those Intel lads.
I'm blue. You know that one?
Rod Stewart.
either Eiffel 65, wasn't it?
Ah, yes, Eiffel 65.
Either him or...
The Blue Man Group,
indeed.
He's one of them.
But he's got an E in his mouth. And I
the
say,
letter.
Indeed, it's more Sesame Street than Leet. But apparently the publisher wanted Irvin himself to pose for that picture. He reckons that that would have been a mistake, and I kind of agree with him there.
Yeah.
That's going overboard with the kind of commercialism. But this man looks well anyway.
It looks.
You get the back of his head then on the back as well.
The back of his head isn't as impressive as the front.
No.
But,
no.
He's got some, his teeth are fairly white. A few,
they could have been coloured in like the rest
of
them.
Well, no, he's got a good few fillings at the back, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very, very striking book cover, it has to be said.
That is, you wouldn't miss it.
This book is dedicated to our old friend Sandy McNair.
Everything's dedicated to that fucker.
Well, we talked about him on the last episode, possibly one of the inspirations for the character of Sandy in Marabou Stork, other than that real footballer who
Jamie Sanderson.
Yeah, him. And there's a quote at the start by our good friend Iggy Pop, who pops up quite often in Welsh creations.
In Welsh mythology.
Indeed.
Like a dragon.
They say that death kills you, but death doesn't kill you. Boredom and indifference kills you. I'm not sure if that's from a song or not, but anyway.
I presume it is, yeah.
He said it. But there is song lyrics to come from Mr. Pop, so stay tuned for that.
If you met Iggy Pop, would you call him Mr. Pop?
Or just
go straight to Iggy?
I'd definitely call him Mr. Pop, and I'd never stop even if he wanted me to.
Even if he insisted.
Once you pop, you just can't stop.
Thank you, Mr. Pop.
There was an Iggy Pop Barker in the Day to Day.
Was there?
Yeah, well, he was obviously a made-up character. Yeah, yeah. He was in there.
What was he doing?
He was a news reporter.
Like, Pop Barker.
Yeah, I can't remember.
I remember
it was Earl Coogan himself who played it, or Chris Morris. But yeah, Iggy Pop Barker.
Mm.
Not as good as Peter O'Hanrahan.
O'Hanrahan.
And Ted Mall. But he was there
today. Now there's a program.
Oh, fantastic. Maybe we should stop doing this and do a day-to-day podcast.
Just play the clip of it.
That might be copyright infringement.
Well, we could act it out in our own inimitable style.
Anyway, do you want to do the first story?
I'll get a can first, yeah.
So. So, yeah, this is basically, we've three stories here. I suppose three novellas, really. They're a bit long to be classed as short stories.
They're long enough, all right, yeah.
Maybe not the first one, but anyway. Mm. The first one is entitled Lorraine Goes to Livingston. Yes?
It certainly is. It's a...
it's an interesting story.
It's a story about this one who gets on the train and heads to Livingston.
That's pretty much it, yeah.
A few bits happen in between.
There is, yeah. There's kind of, I'd say, maybe six main characters. The first two...
Well, there's one main character.
Yeah, we'll get to him. But the first character, or couple of characters that we're introduced to, is an American writer called Rebecca Navarro. Yeah. She's married to Perky Navarro.
It's quite the name.
He sounds like a lovely character, but he's definitely not.
No, she calls him Perkster and everything. I like it.
She does. Perkmania is running wild. But yeah, she's a writer. By all accounts, she's
very
successful. Well, successful, but also overweight.
Yes.
And when we join her, she's chomping down on some rum truffles.
And snorting as she chomps.
And obviously swallows a couple a bit too hastily and starts choking and then has a stroke.
Yes, it was unfortunate.
Yeah, so she was in the middle of writing her next installment of a kind of cheesy Mills and Boone style.
Yeah, romantic.
19th century romance,
yes.
Fucking novels. They have such catchy titles as Paula Goes to Portsmouth.
And Yasmin Goes to Yeovil.
Was that one of them?
Yeah.
I don't have that down. I have Lucy Goes to Liverpool and Nora Goes to Norwich. But I think Yasmin Goes to Yeovil is the best one. How did they miss that?
Well, Yeovil, there's not much to miss.
But yeah, so she has this stroke and is rushed to hospital, and old Perky's not too bothered.
He's quite happy with it.
He's definitely seeing the possibilities of it, as long as he's worried that she won't finish this last novel.
He needs the money for her last novel.
Indeed, she's definitely his cash cow.
And then he starts to worry that she could turn into a big fat vegetable, and then he really worries.
Yeah, and he'd have to look after her then. He basically secretly hates his wife. He's a horrible man. I mean, he's encouraging her to write, but only for his benefit. But he still kind of massages her ego as she goes
constantly,
along.
Constantly, yeah.
He's kind of, between him and maybe these bloody shit novels that she's writing, she's kind of created this, you know, overly friendly, exaggerated, childish. She's living in a dream world.
A complete fantasy world she's living
in. Yeah. But yeah, when she's in hospital, like we see the start of him, he's sleazing on the other women and the nurses in the hospital. Mm. One of which is a character called Yvonne. So she's a nurse here in this hospital that Rebecca goes to, St. Hubbins in London. That's the other thing that struck me about this, and I remember it from when I first read it, is it seemed a more upbeat story because it wasn't set in Leith.
Yeah, Leith tends to bring it down a notch or two.
And even going to Africa in Marabou Stark didn't help matters.
But, no.
Just, I don't know, just this London setting, I suppose Rebecca and Perky would live in a nice area.
Mm.
It seemed like a brighter novel from the get-go, even though there's some dark shit to come.
Plenty dark shit.
But She's reading, this nurse Yvonne is reading one of Rebecca's books. She's reading Yasmin Goes to the Oval. Yeah, I have it down here now. A Miss May Regency romance. They sound really good.
Very opulent.
Fair ladies rescued by dashing suitors and whatnot. It actually reminded me of the film Misery.
Yeah.
The novels that your man is writing in them.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolute rubbish. But I think at this stage, we do get introduced to the man of the hour, the main character of this novel, Mr. Freddie Royle.
I see some bio as El Freddie.
Yeah. Describe El Freddie to us there, James.
Jimmy Savile.
Indeed, that's pretty much it. I mean, and even I do remember reading this and thinking this sounds very familiar. And
I think Jimmy Savile's probably worse than him.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. Because in fact, now there is one instance where this Freddie. Man is working on a kids program and has a child on his lap and is starting to get aroused. But that's the only mention of him being a paedophile. Mm. Other than that, he's just your run-the-mill necrophile.
Yeah, he's big into the necrophilia.
He really is. But yeah, this came up. I just have a little article that I snippeted out here. So following the 2002 Savile abuse sex scandal, commentators remarked on the seemingly uncanny resemblance between the character of Freddie Royle and Savile, and Welch has stated that he was aware of Savile rumours at the time. He has stated, "I had nothing to do with the hospital services or NHS trusts or the BBC, so how come I knew about this rumour?" And that's it. Just question mark.
Well, everyone knew about it.
Apparently so. I mean, this must have been really on the grapevine. I mean, I've looked it up since. There's actually a YouTube video of a load of kind of jokes about Jimmy Savile through the years. Fancy Football's on it with Skinner and Badil. They're all cracking jokes about this fucker. But
he got away with it for many years.
He really fucking did. But when I seen Welch in person, he was doing a book signing here in Dublin. Well, we're not in Dublin, but we're close to it. For the book A Decent Ride in 2015. You can see my handsome photo with Mr. Welch on our social media accounts, by the way. But somebody asked him a question about this, and he mentioned, I think he said that his auntie worked in the Leeds Infirmary. So she knew all about this, and it was, you know, very much an open secret. But apparently Welch was spoken to with the police, just, you know, had a routine chat to ask him how exactly he was able to write this character back in the day. But obviously many people could have wrote about this, a similar character to old Freddie here. But yeah, back to the fictional character of Freddie Royle.
When he's introduced, one of his sayings was very good. "There's nothing like the sight of a stiff to give Freddie Royle a stiffy."
Unbelievable. And he's, well, I think they don't make him from Leeds, but he's from Devon.
He's from Devon.
I say Day. Or
he's from Uar country.
Yeah, yes. But he's still got kind of very similar kind of sayings. I think they said one of his shows was called "How's That?" But yeah, he's basically gone to the morgue in the hospital to have sex with the corpses.
Yes.
And has a long-standing agreement with the authorities there.
Glenn.
Well, Glenn is the next character that's introduced. He's a... What is he? A morgue assistant?
Morgue lad.
Morgue lad.
Hangs around with stiffs.
Does he know Morag, Jamrag, Henderson from Tradespot?
That's his mother.
But yeah, Freddie is paying off Glenn. He's a pathology lab technician, it says here in my notes.
All
right. But yeah, all the hospital trustees fully know what Freddie's up to.
He's bringing in so much money to them.
Indeed.
He's paying their wages, basically.
Well, who wouldn't be when they host a show called From Fred with Love? So the next character that's introduced is, I suppose, the titular character, Lorraine herself, Lorraine Gillespie. Apparently a good-looking girl, a Scottish nurse.
This certainly is perked up perky.
She, indeed. And anyone else that came within her grasp. But she's representing Scotland. She's our...
She is the flower of Scotland.
She's the representative for Welch in this novel anyway. But she loves going clubbing. She's big into jungle music, much like Brendan Grace's character from Father Ted. What was his name?
Oh, what the fuck was his name?
Everyone knows who we mean, and he's fantastic. He's the best character in Father Ted, basically. She becomes the object of Glenn's affections, but then he changes his mind. He goes to a jungle night. that Lorraine and Yvonne are attending themselves, and he changes his mind once he meets Yvonne, which is, he's perfectly entitled
Father
to do that.
Father Fintonstack.
There we go. Thanks to our research analysis there, James King. So maybe Father Fintan was at this jungle night as well.
But no doubt.
In the 90s, I'm sure he was.
He was ahead of his time.
He had his fun, and that's all that matters. Glenn, you know, he's a young man. He's changed his mind here. He's gone for Yvonne rather than Lorraine. That's fine. Next, we see Freddie himself visiting Rebecca in hospital.
Yeah.
She's obviously oblivious to his real intentions. I think he's basically sizing her up here to see if she's on death's door.
No, they're friends.
Yeah, well, that doesn't stop him in any shape or form, as we find out towards the end of the story. But yeah, we see more of the fact that, you know, Rebecca lives in this kind of naive, fucking childish fantasy world. But Freddie, he goes to visit her because indeed they are friends. But on his way out, he spots another overweight woman who's definitely on death's door and asks a nurse about her. And I always remember this from the first time I read it. He remarks that it'll be like climbing Everest.
It'll be like Everest.
He's kind of mixed a bit of Fred West in here with Jimmy Savile, hasn't
definitely
he?
Fred West.
Combined the two, and that would make sense with the timeline here when this book would have been written and come out. But then we get introduced to the actual world of Rebecca's story here. Lorraine goes to Livington. So it starts off.
The two lads, we find out that Perky and...
Oh, yeah.
Perky and what's his name? Freddie are good mates.
Indeed.
They meet in this dodgy porno shop.
Yes, they frequent the same publication establishment.
Where you have to secret knock and get into the back room.
Oh, my
and
God.
It's just filth in there.
The days before the internet.
Yeah. So you'd have all these fucking spunk-tripping weirdos walking around the same place.
Basically a physical embodiment of the dark web.
Yes, pretty much, yes.
Yeah, they're good mates. But, we get introduced into Lorraine Goes to Livingston, the story within a story.
Mm.
And it kind of starts off, as I imagine most of Rebecca's stories do, just a fair maiden, Lorraine herself. Obviously inspired by the real life nurse Lorraine.
Who's helping her.
Yeah, I think she's an orphan, is she? And she's been sent down.
No,
but she's hanging around with this madam.
She was, in the story, she was living up in Scotland, I think.
Mm, from a rich
enough family. I think he was a reverend.
I didn't pay attention and to the story whatsoever.
Yeah, then they sent her down to London to meet a man. Then she moved in with these well-to-do crowd.
Indeed, to be introduced into society, as
that's it,
were.
It, yeah.
And this is the man who I, again, remembered from first reading this, the Earl of Denbigh. if there was one thing I remember from the book Ecstasy, it's this man. But
he starts off quite normal.
He does. He seems very nice.
There is a bit of a deterioration as
big time.
As
he loves his wife dearly, Lady Harrington. Why isn't she Lady Denbigh?
It's a good question.
Anyway, she dies, so we don't need to worry about her for too long.
She's brown bread.
She falls down a fucking flight of stairs.
Yeah, in the middle of a big fucking big banquet. She trips over her skirt and boom, boom, dead.
That reminds me of that sketch in Sesame Street years ago. I remember where the chef stood at the top of the stairs. 12 cream pies. And that sounds Christmassy, but you know what I mean. And
that's exactly how she died.
But yeah, he's a broken man after this.
Oh, completely shattered.
Yeah. But Lorraine is the object of every man's desires as soon as she appears there. It gets quite lecherous very quickly.
She's a big ride.
Not to be confused with the big ride from Marabou Star Climbers.
Yeah. Similar, I'd say.
But we go back to We go back to the other story, the story not within the other story.
The other story.
Indeed. And yeah, Rebecca... befriends Lorraine, the nurse,
who's looking after her.
Starts getting kind of really life lessons from her. She kind of encourages her to wise up and cop on to. She finds out about El Perky, doesn't she? She finds out that he's been ripping
her. Oh, she does. Yeah,
she follows him. Is that what? No, does she get Lorraine to follow him?
Let me see.
She does. She's still decked out in bed, and she gets Lorraine to follow him. And Lorraine finds out about this secret flat.
He has a secret flat. Yeah.
He's got a huge porn stash. Of whatever tickles your fancy.
I wouldn't say it's regular.
No, the mind boggles. Lots of receipts from the good life, drinking, gambling, prostitutes. This is where
lots of
Rebecca's hard-earned money has gone to. So, yeah, Lorraine basically tells Rebecca to, you know, wise up and get even. Perky comes on to Lorraine then. They set up a situation coming on to her in the car, I believe.
Offers her a few bob for a wank or something.
But Lorraine's Scottish heritage comes out big style. She gives him an old headbutt.
She grabs his bollocks first.
She grabs his bollocks squeezes as well. Yeah.
Very uncomfortably.
Yeah, absolutely.
At the beginning, he was enjoying it, but then as she gradually crushed his testicles more and more, he felt a shriek of pain, and then she loathed him.
Indeed, as Morrissey once said, that joke isn't funny anymore.
And what do you say? He likes them feisty, but not that feisty.
But El Perky himself then finds Rebecca's manuscript, and the novel has taken a turn for a strange...
It's definitely... gone down a meander down a different
he can't stream. Believe what he's reading. So the Earl of Denby, as we said, has sunk into serious depression. He's drinking and visiting opium dens
with a lot of Chinamen.
we join him. He's blindfolded and partaking in a wager with a colleague of his who has set up basically a young girl. This is actually horrific, but again, in Welsh style, he's kind of written it comically, so I don't know, it's just
That's so far-fetched, this. It's not like real life.
Yeah, but it's weird. But it is essentially a young girl and a boy being assaulted, and also an act of bestiality. So disgusting, I can't even say the word properly.
Shaved sheep.
Indeed. Strategically shaved in the nether regions. So he's blindfolded, as we say, and it's a bit like the Pepsi Challenge, but with arses.
There's three of them, there's not just two of them.
No, it's a young girl, young boy, and a sheep, the terrible victims in this horrendous wager. And after sodomizing all three, and this is the line that I always remembered from the book, was when he was doing the sheep was obviously trying to get away from him, and Earl of Denby shouts, "I am Denby, yield, damn you." So he incorrectly guesses that that was the young boy. Obviously, on sight, he fancied the young boy most.
Yes.
But it was the sheep's rectum that he actually preferred.
That took his fancy the most.
Indeed. Much to the amusement of everyone that was in attendance. But
then he did declare after it that buggery is buggery.
Probably written on his tombstone. But
I imagine so.
He does make an honest sheep of the sheep.
Yep.
He takes it in as his live-in lover, Flossie, as she becomes known.
Yeah.
And she's basically living the life of any royal. She's sitting in bed being waited on hand and foot by servants.
And buggered by the Earl.
He does carry on a sexual relationship with her, it has to be said.
He kisses her and everything. It's not just a physical thing, it's emotional. Yeah,
he's bonded. Everything. It's true love, James.
Yes.
But Lorraine follows him. He's still frequenting the old opium dens as well. And there's this weird bit where Lorraine follows him one day. And as she's outside playing kind of amateur detective, she's strongly propositioned by two men. Are they soldiers?
Two soldiers, yeah.
Back from the
front.
Yes, and horny and willing to commit acts of...
rape.
Yeah, basically. But lucky for Lorraine, Marcus Cox... comes along, a good friend of the Earl, and he demands satisfaction. So basically, he offers these two young soldiers the chance to get the shit kicked out of them. But what he would prefer, they don't want to have the shit kicked out of them. So they go for what they see as a slightly better option of being buggered by Marcus Cox. And he, Lorraine is sent back to the horse and carriage, but can hear the commotion. And here's old Mr. Cox shouting, "I will have satisfaction."
And he did.
He's buggered. And then pops back into the carriage himself and goes, "Sorry about that." It's something along these lines. That had to be done kind of thing.
He couldn't have cleaned himself up that quickly.
I'm sure the two lads didn't either.
No.
Fucking
Jesus.
Hell.
Welsh is obsessed with bum riding.
He really is. I can only imagine at this point that it had been said back to him many times. So he just decided to start trolling his audience.
Yeah, maybe.
But then Lorraine hatches a plan to kill Flossie. And she ends up getting served to the Earl of Denby as dinner that night.
The innocent victim in all this was Flossie.
She really was. Yes, the one innocent character possibly in this whole book, really.
Gets eaten.
Indeed. Obviously, the Earl is enraged by this, but then he kind of realises that Lorraine did it out of love. And then he realises he loves her as well. this much, much younger girl. So the story kind of ends up in a warped way, ending the way most of Rebecca's romance novels probably end, you know, happy ever after.
Happy ever after.
But Perky is certainly less than pleased with her new writing style and thinks this could
be... He thinks it's a change for the worst.
Could be the downfall of her writing career, all right. But we also get these kind of little sub-chapters where Freddie is indulging himself with...
A bugger in the scrum.
Yes, that's the first one, indeed. I don't know if you want to talk about the bugger in the scrum. I know I have one of them in the disturbing section. So a rugby player has died... And is wheeled in, and basically Freddie.
Oh yeah, this is the one.
Constructs a splint on the dead man's penis.
Yeah,
so obviously, and then waits for rigor mortis just to set in.
So he's as hard as a rock for him.
So obviously, Freddie is going to be the
not his first rodeo when it comes to this.
No,
sort of thing.
Certainly not. Obviously, Freddie's going to be the taker in this little arrangement, but the damage on the rugby player's body arises suspicion from a pathologist starts an investigation. But Freddie is in well with Alan Sweet, who's the hospital trust manager. And they actually drug the pathologist. And when he wakes up...
He's been saddled by a couple of prostitutes.
Yeah, they've set him up in Perky's old flat.
Yeah.
And one prostitute is pegging him. We described on the Acid House movie episode what pegging is. We don't need to go into that.
Do we?
Yeah, we did, yeah. But they're basically ensuring the silence of this pathologist, you know, with these incriminating
blackmail.
You have to wonder, did this happen without Jimmy Savile as well in real life?
He was doing it so much. He couldn't have been buggering. So he couldn't have done this to so many people.
It's unbelievable. But El Perky doesn't realize that he's very much under the watchful eye of Rebecca. He walks out of a bar pissed and right into a car and is rushed to hospital himself. And just before he dies, I love this. Just before he dies, he sees people around his hospital bed. And one of them is El Freddie, who's grinning at him.
Licking his lips.
And he... reassuring him by his bedside, and now Perky just knows what's going to happen to him in the next life.
What about the one where you're at the...
We have that in the disturbing. Oh, right. We'll get to it in just a minute, James. You can describe that one. But basically the story ends with... this is kind of the recurring theme in all three stories, you know, is the drug of ecstasy. So Rebecca is obviously... up and on her feet and out of hospital.
Losing a load of weight.
Has lost a load of weight.
Gets her life back together.
Probably earned a few quid from her new style of writing.
Maybe not.
I'm sure some people would have wanted to pick up that. But yeah, her and Lorraine go to the next jungle night with Father Fintan.
Fintan Stack.
Yeah. They eat off their tits and happy as Larry. Or Freddy.
Yeah. It was a very roundabout way to a story about like an ecstasy.
Yeah, that he just kind of slipped that in there, and it's loose.
Freddie, action. Yeah.
It was more so about El Frederick.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the character Glenn, he's really just there as the kind of gateway for Freddie.
He's a nothing.
He's a nothing character. And Lorraine, you know, obviously Rebecca. What do I have? Do you want to do the disturbing bits? Well, any favourite bits of writing, actually, James, in this story? No?
The bit where...
Root it out there. Tell us what page it is. We'll wait.
Where the fuck is it? So there was a fire at a gay nightclub, I think it was.
Okay, you're putting this down as your favourite writing. I had this in Disturbing.
Oh, yeah.
But go for it. Yeah, same difference.
Right, I have to find it first.
I do. I have it down here if you want.
All right. Go on, read it out there. It's just classic.
So where are we? No, I have the page. It's 65. Lord of the Rings is the chapter.
Aptly so.
It's not that long, or is it?
No, it's just...
The gist of it.
It's one page.
Yeah.
And it's... Well, I read the whole thing.
Go on. If you're happy to read it, go for it.
The corpse has been pulled out of the burning warehouse early that morning. Glenn winced as he looked at it. Desensitized as he had become to dead bodies, some of them in abominable states... He had never come across one like this. The flesh was burned from the top half of the body. The face unrecognisable. Ominously, as Glenn heard the heavy breathing of Freddie Royal behind him, he saw that the buttocks were almost untouched by the consuming flames. So this was a regular arse bandit then, was it? Freddie Gerard. Well, yeah, I mean, it was a fire in a gay disco. The geezer's boyfriend in to identify the body. Glenn nodded at the charred mess. How could you recognise the ring? He could only recognise the ring. That's how he was able to make the identification. Freddie thrust his index finger into the corpse's arsehole. Yeah, it's about the only thing that ain't been damaged. I don't know how he could tell the difference, though. Most of them look the same to me. Must have been true love, eh? Glenn shook his head and pointed to the gold band which was on the one of the body's charred fingers. That ring, Freddie said. Oh, I see what you mean, me old matey. Freddie laughed.
He's a pirate now.
Glenn was almost gagging as a sickly scent of charred flesh. It seemed to get everywhere. He stuck more of the blocking cream under his nostrils. After he had his way with the corpse, Freddie poured lighter fuel into the arsehole and set it on fire. What are you doing, Christ. Glenn screamed. Just making a little more divulgent for that there pathologist fella to find evidence, Freddie smiled. And Glenn started gagging again.
Yes.
it's quite a chapter.
Yeah, so that was James's favourite bit of writing. That was my most disturbing bit of writing.
You know it was your favourite too.
My favourite bit was on page 26.
Some boring shite.
Yeah, this is kind of just, strangely enough, this is the most boring character in the book, old Glenn. But it was just him talking about kind of the state of play, and it's probably something that Welch maybe felt himself at the time about the state of Britain. And but where are we? All the joy of love for everything good was in him, though he could see all the bad things in Britain. In fact, this 20th century urban blues music defined and illustrated them more sharply than ever. Yet he wasn't scared and he wasn't down about it. He could see what needed to be done to get away from them. It was the party. He felt that you had to party. You had to party harder than ever. It was the only way. It was your duty to show that you were still alive. Political sloganing and posturing meant nothing. You had to celebrate the joy of life in the face of it all, in face of all those grey forces and dead spirits who controlled everything, who fucked with your head and livelihood anyway, if you weren't one of them. You had to let them know that in spite of their best efforts to make you like them, to make you dead, you were still alive.
Well, that's your favourite bit of writing.
Listen, it's not a story for favourite writing.
All right,
it's
sorry.
A story for really fucked up shit, I think. So that was kind of the most normal bit of writing that made you think about something other than buggering corpses.
And sheep.
Anyway, we're gonna keep our overall thoughts, I guess, for the book in general. And we'll certainly wait till the end to do our marks out of five. But just, what did you think about this story in the short term?
Oh, it was a good story. It was a shocking, it was fast-paced, shocking, and funny. Funny a bit, very dark now. Mm. A lot of people won't find it funny, but if you have a dark sense of humour, you'll find it very funny.
Yeah, big time. I mean, the thing I noticed about it, disturbingly, is that the only non-drug-fueled passion in the book was displayed by Freddie himself. Everyone else was after tits on yolks and couldn't really be trusted as to who they loved and who they didn't.
The mere smell of a corpse set Freddie off.
Yeah, like everyone else's relationships were kind of based on an aspect of falseness.
Yeah.
Whereas Freddie knew...
He was so true to his heart.
Yeah, it was in a warped way.
He might have been fucked up heart, but he was...
Well, and of course, we mentioned that it all ends nice for Rebecca. You know, she's gotten rid of Perky. And it has a happy ending in that respect, but not really, because Freddie's still at large at the end of the story. But I suppose it is, Rebecca's story arc is a happy one, and it's nice to see a female character in a Welsh novel doing well for herself.
Yeah, it's a fucking rarity, all right.
Even if she is off her box, on yolks, and might have a different outlook on life on Monday morning. Freddie, I mean, like Begbie, he's written with this air of comedy and slapstick to him. That on paper, you know, it just makes these horrible acts somewhat more palatable, which sounds terrible to say, but it is true.
The way it's written, they are very funny. The way, even like his accent and all that, the way he says stuff, it is very funny.
Yeah. I mean, It is an enjoyable story, as I say. Just somehow it's got an upbeat and happy feel to it.
A happy ending as well.
Indeed, for everyone. And the whole Earl of Denby thing is just fucking hilarious and very unforgettable. I mean, it is the one part of the book that I remembered from the first time I read it in, 25 years ago.
Yeah, fucking hell.
But, I mean, Welch's kind of clever commentary on Savile here, basically Savile. Let's face it, many other, you know, there was a lot more celebrity deviants on the loose at this time as well.
There was fucking loads of them.
This kind of speaks on all of them and what they got away with for so long. So it's good in that respect. But I suppose the manner in which his crimes are written here, it just, as I say, it makes it quite comical. But I don't know if this would have translated into a film adaptation.
It might have been hard to find the humour in the film.
But then again, it's 2021 and we've seen almost everything, so maybe.
Burning a corpse's arsehole out.
We can live and hope that we'll get another adaptation of this story.
Mm.
But as I say, we'll leave the overall marks for the end. We'll move on to our next story.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, our next story is entitled Fortune's Always Hiding.
Mm.
Do you know where that's from?
No.
It's actually a line from I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles.
Oh, the old fucking hammers.
Which, of course, makes sense because one of the main characters here, old Dave, is a West Ham fan.
Mm.
Just on I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, it, of course, wasn't created for West Ham. It was around long before them, as most football songs would be. This was actually from a Broadway musical from much earlier in the 20th century called The Passing Show of 1918.
Very interesting.
Just so you know. And of course...
What was it about?
I have no idea. Passing wind, I think. Hence why I'm forever blowing bubbles. But of course, the song most famously sung much later by Michael Jackson. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry for slurring the good name
of Bubbles.
Of the king of pop.
Fuck him. Poor Bubbles is the victim here.
I think I've stolen that from Ricky Gervais, that joke. But anyway.
As long as he's not looking for royalties, you'll be all right.
Well, he's not going to hear this, so no worries.
Jeez, I don't know about that. Our tentacles stretch fairly far.
Okay, well, let's end this happy tomfoolery right now and start the story. And it starts pretty fucking darkly with a German pharmacist who's living in a small town in Germany.
Bavaria.
And their child is kidnapped and then fucking posted back to them in bits.
Mm.
Which, I mean, we mentioned that this book is kind of more upbeat and has a happier tone to it than previous Welch ones. This story doesn't, and this part certainly doesn't, but it's over pretty quickly. They don't go into much detail, thank God, but...
They blame terrorists, isn't it?
Yeah. But the man, as you say, was a pharmacist and Gunther knows himself. Yeah.
He knows the reason.
Gunther from Friends.
Yeah. Bastard.
He knows, that his past is catching up with him and he blows his face off.
Mm.
And his wife goes catatonic. I can't think why. But we cut then to this character of Dave, who we mentioned. He is a West Ham fan, a bit of a hooligan by all accounts.
Irvin Welsh just outdoes himself with characters that have no redeeming qualities. He's an absolute prick. Oh, my God.
I suppose we must mention... most people who listen to this probably know it, but south of the border, Old Irvin supports West Ham.
Does he?
He does indeed, yeah.
Jesus.
He's a few teams. He supports Bose as well. When he was living over here, he was going to Bohemians.
That's fucking poncy, that is.
Anyway, so Dave is a West Ham fan, and we get a lot of accounting of his tales of beating up... people.
His own fans, even. He's just an absolute twat.
He beats it. That's how we're introduced to him. He's beaten up two other Hammer fans with his mate. But then he kind of says afterwards, everyone is all right to him. But really, he's an absolute paranoid tug, and his paranoia gets worse and worse as the story goes on.
I just hate him. I hate reading the the chapters where he was in it, he was just, oh, fuck up.
He's a real...
he's like Danny Dyer on steroids.
Yeah.
It's just,
yeah. Oh, he's a real God. Kind of British bulldog. There is a bit where they actually raid a house and rob a family and terrorize a family. And as we're getting his story, we're also getting this kind of building up story of the birth and creation of this drug. It's obviously Welsh didn't want to use the actual drug of, what's it called?
Tamiflu.
Yeah. He wanted to use this made up name of tenazidrine.
Tenazidrine, yeah.
So we get the creation of that in 1961 by a man who spearheads it is called Bruce Sturgis.
Sturgis.
Yes. Fucking just can't pronounce any surname in these.
Well, you are
heft
up on goofballs tonight.
I'm trying to finish the podcast before I reach top goofiness. But I think it becomes obvious fairly quickly how the story's going to go because we get the birth of this girl, Samantha. She is born with this deformity.
No arms.
No arms, basically. And we slowly see her life as she gets older and just the kind of continued modern day life of old Dave.
Fuck's sake.
But, we see Dave, there's one bit where he picks up his son. He's, you know, he even has kind of unsatisfying sex with his ex.
I'd call it more than rape.
Yeah, he's basically bullying her, but she's, you know, I don't know, she'd probably have him back at the drop of a hat, but, I mean, once again, we're getting a kind of downtrodden female character who we certainly don't get her point of view in this story. We just get his, but he's so unsatisfied with the sex with her that he goes home and has sex with a melon.
Yes, he's bored a hole into a melon, which is bad enough, but the fact that he uses it more than once is even worse.
Well, he's very fond of recycling.
True, true. He was ahead of his time.
Did he have a picture on the wall as he was doing it?
No, I think he was just riding a melon. I
thought he had a bit of inspiration.
Did he?
I thought so. But he's the father of the year as well because he actually dumped his son with his sister straight after picking him up from the mother's so he could go home and shag this melon. Yeah. So he's a great dad as well, on top of being a stand-up citizen in normal society. We show him then kind of eat up. Here's where the ecstasy connection comes in again. Very loose ecstasy connection where he meets Samantha for the first time and it's kind of obviously a typical scenario for her where he's staring at her because she's clearly a very good looking woman,
but she's got flippers.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. And it keeps flipping back, no pun intended, it keeps flipping back and forward to her life growing up.
Yeah.
And it shows her in 1979 living in London as part of the punk movement, and she actually meets another tenazidrine victim just by chance in a German chap called Andreas in a cafe, and she kind of loves his kind of assertive attitude to their condition and life in general. He's just getting on with things and is not taking it. I think he fucking does he headbutt somebody or threatens to bite someone's fucking nose off.
Yeah, three lads come up and start slagging him and he says he's going to bite his face off.
Yeah.
And the three lads just fuck off.
Yes, he's obviously quite convincing. So she falls in love with him and she dangerously falls in love with him. She's kind of, she's doing whatever he says for a long time in actual fact. But what you call it, Dave then in present time becomes infatuated himself with Samantha. But it's weird. He's just kind of, it doesn't seem like real love.
No.
Which is hard to believe with a character like Dave.
Character is, well, yeah.
He's just sexually infatuated with her, really. He finds that he's quite fond of the flippers himself.
Yeah, well, it's hard to believe that someone, a bigger prick as he is, would fall in love with anyone apart from himself. Like, well,
that's it. He's saying he's in love with her, but really he's just constantly talking about sex.
Yeah,
she's not exactly sitting around and doing a crossword with her. He's not too pushed about what's going on in her head.
She wanks him off with her feet, and he's quite happy with that.
Yes, indeed. And at the same time, we get this guy, Bruce Sturgis, who, you know, the guilt is starting to get to him, and He can't get deformities out of his head.
Yeah, but he mentions...
Which wasn't a song by Kylie Minogue, by the way.
He mentions that the German, back when they were making the drug, the German guy was telling him there was problems. So that was obviously Gunter.
Yes, indeed. So it's all coming together now.
Just revenge. You can see revenge coming.
Yeah, and you're wondering straight away, you know, who was it that kidnapped the child and killed it?
It's becoming fairly obvious,
all right. Samantha starts convincing Dave then that she wants revenge. We see Dave his best mate, Bal. They have a car maintenance business, which is obviously just a fucking cover for them being drug dealers and robbing people in their houses.
The lockup.
Yeah.
Like the Mitchells.
Indeed, yeah. I didn't see that connection. But they get visited by a copper who's warning them away from a Millwall game that weekend.
One of the teams running through Dave's shitty life is revenge against Millwall.
Yeah.
Some big Millwall lad who battered him, I think, previously.
Yeah.
And he wants revenge. But he never gets it, thank fuck.
So in that sense, quite similar to our good friend Roy Strang, who's really into violence and whatnot. Unfortunately for El Roy, he never found true love the way Dave did.
No, he obviously never met a woman with flippers.
No, certainly not. But he's all the while getting paranoid, even though he's seen this lovely girl. He's still, you know, got increasing paranoia and is worried that even his close friends are fucking cheating him out of drug deals and whatnot.
The backstory of Samantha and Andreas causing a bit of hassle.
Oh, yes. So they killed another one of Sturgis's colleagues, old Barney. Snuck up on him in his hotel, in a country retreat, and murdered him. I think that was in 1982.
Yeah, that's that. They didn't speak after that. They went their separate ways.
Yeah, so she's obviously started. In fairness, we think when I first read it in 1996, I don't remember what I thought, but when I was rereading this, straight away you knew it was fucking Samantha that was involved in the kidnapping of that German fella's kid. But I just thought that she was full on bent on revenge, and she is.
Hmm.
But what isn't really revealed till the story goes on is that she does have a lot of guilt about what she's doing, but just can't fucking stop it.
Yes.
And she certainly doesn't want really anything to do with Andreas when it gets up to the modern, present day, I should say, not modern. Because Andreas kind of has almost political ambitions. He's trying to change
the world.
Yeah, stick it to the man and whatnot. But whereas she just wants personal revenge, but it does show her involved with him and assaulting the copper at a miners' rally. So again, it was probably indifference to her as to what the occasion was. She just wanted to assault somebody. Did it describe how she did it? She must have just fucking headbutted him.
Well, what else could she do?
Or biting.
Or kicking.
Yeah. Sturgis, again, we see his life. So, you know, he's actually gotten a knighthood, I believe.
Yes, he has. And he's a... raging homosexual as well.
He is indeed. He likes to frequent certain areas of London where rent boys hang out. He misses poor Barney. And he also remembers that the German guy, you know, he's just remembering all the past involving this drug. It's never far from his mind, the kind of guilty thoughts about the drug and what it did. But there's a bit where old Dave and the firm go to a Newcastle game.
Yeah.
And they've kind of hatched a plan where they descend on the city in different spots.
Doesn't work out so well.
No. But he ends up just assaulting a normal bloke. I found it funny here. He was described as a real train spotting guy. So obviously a kind of play on the pun, you know, that the film Trainspotting wasn't actually about train spotting. But this guy fell victim. I think I mentioned on the Trainspotting film episode that Noel Gallagher declined having an Oasis song involved in the film because he thought it was about fucking Trainspotting.
Indeed.
But he was all for it by the time the premiere came around. He was first in line to be seen.
It's a bit late, Danny Boyle.
But I liked the bit where obviously a big Geordie nutbag up there met up with old Dave, and they kind of agreed to disagree and just kind of laughed and went their separate ways without all out murder breaking out. But I suppose being E'd up on the train probably helped with that as well, a little bit.
Share the love.
Indeed. But yeah, old Mr. Sturgis, he's off with a rent boy, and then we see that Dave has started to follow him, obviously on the instruction or the order of Samantha. And
I didn't get this bit.
Which bit?
Where he fucks off with the rent boy.
Well, I think he was just trying to get information about Sturgis's habits as to when he could kind of nab him. But what happens here is...
I don't get why.
Well, he's possibly a fucking closet homosexual.
Clearly
I don't know.
He is.
He certainly has a thirst for violence anyway. Yeah, I just thought he was trying to play a kind of a detective here following Sturgis. But then decided to stop off for some horrible violence on a
he's
poor
no
red
He's no fucking
boy.
Bergerac, I can tell you that.
And hey, he's certainly not a Taggart. Yeah, he does accept oral sex off this rent boy.
He does.
For a while, but he doesn't get aroused until he starts beating the shit out of him while he's doing it. Like it's
knocks his teeth out.
He does, yeah. It's disturbing stuff. It's an interesting example, in fairness, of Welch showing how kind of violence and power is more important to the rapist than actual sex. But goes back to Andreas. I think she meets up with Andreas in the present day and kind of shows that he no longer has the hold over.
There's no power over anymore.
Yeah. He demanded the death of the German baby as a sacrifice. But he saw it more as a cause rather than, you know, no personal revenge per se, just to take down the system. All bollocks, obviously. Not that there's any fucking justification for doing something as horrible as that. But Samantha says she no longer wants anything to do with him.
Mm. And Sturgis is mine.
Indeed, yeah. She warns him off Sturgis. So it's weird. She doesn't want anything to do with Andreas, but she still fucking wants to do pretty much what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And quicker than him as well. He wanted to wait.
Yeah, he waited. There was a good bit of time in between Barney getting killed and the baby getting killed.
Yeah, there's this kind of, I think we mentioned it, this deep-seated sense of revenge, so very akin to Marabou Stork or that story Bad Blood, which was a chapter within Trainspotting.
In fairness, they did have a reason for wanting revenge.
You did, yeah. The other thing to mention about old Dave here is he's a big fan of ABC.
Massive fan. Jesus Christ.
This is something that comes up again a lot with Irvin Welch. I mentioned it briefly in relation to Begbie. Begbie likes listening to Tapao and Berlin, Take My Breath Away.
Classics.
And you'll read yourself in El Filth that the main character in that, the Bent Copper, Bruce Dickinson.
Bruce Dickinson. Bent Copper's the Iron Maiden lead singer.
Robertson. I'm fucking way off here. Anyway, he's mad into...
Bruce Dickinson.
Michael Bolton.
Oh, Jesus.
Among some really crap heavy metal bands like Saxon, or I don't even know if they're classed as heavy metal.
Okay, pretty much pre-metal.
I looked them up. They do some good shit.
That is serious.
But old Dave is mad into fucking ABC, and he's listening to the album The Lexicon of Love in his car. He's listening to that as he's assaulting that rent boy.
Yeah.
And he's also listening to it as he kidnaps Sturgis. So that's the ending of the book here. And I must say as well, for added effect, I knew the story and I knew he was mad into ABC. As I was finishing reading the story, I stuck the Lexicon of Love on the old Alexa over there.
On the wireless.
I did. And we're just shut up, Alexa. I didn't mean you. Well, I did, but...
Shut up.
So Dave lures...
Meets him in a gay bar.
He does, yeah.
Chats him up.
Talks him into getting into his car, plays ABC in the car, and brings him to the lockup, yeah. Old Bal isn't there. Grant and Phil aren't there.
No.
But Samantha...
Peggy's not there.
Peggy's definitely not there. Well, she has a pub to run.
True.
But Samantha was there waiting.
With a chainsaw.
Yes, indeed. And this is fucking unbelievable shit. The cops were actually watching Dave.
Millwall match.
Yes, that's what it was. Sorry, I'll take that shit out.
So the cops look unprofessional.
The cops are following Dave. They obviously see that he's taking this man into his lockup.
For a bum.
Well, and then the cops are trying to get in and Dave is holding the door closed with his arm.
And it's snapping.
And it's fucking snapping. And at the same time, Samantha is using her feet, stroke flippers, to start up the chainsaw and just starts hacking away. Does she go up the middle of him? Like
no, she gets rid of his arms first, and then
of course, yes.
Then she does the rest.
Yeah, and that's the lovely ending of it. I just have a bit of favourite writing here. It's page 149 and 150, James. I'll do it quickly here. So this is where Samantha has the chainsaw just about to cut up Sturgis, and old Dave is keeping the coppers at bay. So he says, I can hear some filthy cunt's voice at a loudspeaker, but I can't make it out as to what he's saying. All I can hear is the song Poison Arrow blasting inside my head.
Shoot that poison arrow through my heart.
Indeed, that's it. Because it's her that's broken my fucking heart. Because she knew how it would turn out right from the start. And Samantha's getting him. I can hear the searing of the saw, and the pain on my arm is fucking unbearable. This arm will never be able to do linesy of the Millwall after this, as if that matters. I look over to shout at Samantha, do the cunt, Sam. Do the cunt, Sam. Go on, my girl. Do him.
Fucking slag.
The sound of the saw rips as it changes as it rips into the flesh of this queer beast just below the shoulder.
Sure would.
And blood splurts and splashes across the garage floor. I'm thinking about the mess it's going to leave for poor old Bal, who won't be best pleased. And that's a funny thing to think about, because the saw's torn through Sturgis's flesh and it's grinding into the bone. Samantha, there on her arse, saw in her at her feet, ripping the captive screaming beast's limb from him. God, she looks like she does when I'm giving her one, and I hear another splintering, and it's
covered
me
in blood.
And I hear another splintering, and it's me this time. It's my fucking arm, and the pain is just so much I'm gonna black out. Why isn't my fucking voice? Yeah, now it is doing me.
Oh dear,
said the vicar to the nurse. And I'm gonna black out, but I'm catching Samantha's look at me as I fall, and she's shouting something which I can't hear, but I know what it is. I can see it on her lips. She's covered in his blood, which is fucking well splurting everywhere, but she's smiling like a little girl playing in mud, and she's mouthing, I love you, and I'm doing it back, and I'm blacking out, and I don't care, because this is the greatest feeling in the world. Fortune's always hiding, but I found it because I love her, and I've done it. I've looked everywhere. The old Bill can do what they fucking well like. It's all over now, but I don't fucking well care. I'm forever blowing bubbles, pretty bubbles in the...
Dead.
Yeah, he doesn't get to say air. So that's a pretty good image to end the story on, I think.
Yeah. Maybe she was actually mouthing at him, you stupid cunt.
This isn't what I meant at all.
Yeah, yeah. I've just used you, you dopey bastard.
Well, she certainly has. Yeah. But she's, let's face it, it's not exactly a happy ending for her. Like, the cops are going to want to question her.
She'd struggle to give a happy ending, that one.
Not according to Dave.
Well, I suppose, yeah.
Absolute feats of fire.
Footsies.
Footsies. The Footsie 500. Let's move on to, that's our favourite writing. Let's move on to connect. It was also our disturbing writing as well, let's be honest.
It's the same.
Same thing at this stage. Let's move on to connecting lines. Any connecting lines for us, Jem? You do now.
I do. Renton was in it. And Spud.
They certainly were. And Matty.
Matty who?
Matty Connell from Trainspotting. He's not in the film, but he's Tommy gets a lot of his character in the film.
All right.
He dies. But Spud is only mentioned and Matty is only mentioned. Renton's actually in it. So Samantha is sharing a flat with him in 1979. Renton's only 16 at this stage.
Spotty faced.
Yeah.
Chap.
Into the punk scene. And also eating bacon. Strange. Obviously hasn't resorted to his vegetarian ways.
No, you're still heft up on hog anus at that stage.
He certainly is. I think that's all connecting lines for this one. You happy enough with that?
Very happy.
Indeed. So let's move on to our final thoughts for this story. So what did you think of this one, James?
Yeah, this was another good one. Mm? Fast-paced again. A revenge tale, basically.
Yeah.
And they got there in the end. Although, that Dave fella, what a prick. Just, like I said, say it again. Welsh has an unbelievable ability to write characters that you just hate.
Yeah.
Oh my God. He's no redeeming features.
No, he doesn't. No.
Absolutely nothing.
I mean, he's only there really to serve the purpose that, you know, Samantha is able to manipulate him.
Mm.
Yeah, for this one, for me, I think I mentioned it. I think it was fairly obvious early on what the plot was going to be with the, yeah. you know, the the chemist, the pharmacist, and his fucking poor mutilated baby, and who did that. And we just get kind of the backstory leading up to how that came about, and then beyond that with the kidnapping of Sturgis. But the one thing I did like about this story was the character of Samantha, in that she's kind of possibly the first female character Welch has written that's a really strong character. Now, yeah. Strong for the wrong reasons, but it's a bit of a red herring where, as I say, I thought that it was her from the get-go, and it was, but you don't get that she herself was manipulated
for
a number of years by this Andreas character.
Her whole outlook was changed by that, your man Andreas.
Yeah, it's a fucking, the final image of her is horrifying, but it's also a pretty striking image, you know, as it said, playing around in someone's blood like she's playing in mud.
But the more remarkable thing is being able to work a chainsaw with your feet.
Well, exactly, hell. Yeah, I'd like to see that.
What's she going to do with me hands?
You know, she's achieved this kind of warped form of happiness in her eyes, but obviously it's not going to last very long with the police about to break Dave's arm and barge into the room.
She's in for some hard time in prison with no arms.
You're serving hard time.
Big boss man style.
Anyway, that's Fortune's Always Hiding, and we're on to our final story now. So yeah, the final story in Ecstasy, Three Tales of Chemical Romance, is entitled The Undefeated. Another song title. This one's by Iggy Pop himself, Mr. Pop.
Mr. Pop, as we like to call him on this particular podcast.
Indeed. But this story is about a certain character called Lloyd. When we join him, he's at a rave with a few of his mates. One is called Ali.
There's two Lloyds in Leet.
There is.
There's this particular Lloyd.
You're going straight to that, which in fairness is possibly the most interesting thing about this story.
The other Lloyd is a sex with a sister.
Yeah, Lloyd Beatty.
Yeah, and this fella is Lloyd, they're very similar name, Boost. So
yeah.
He used to get a bit of hassle over that.
He does. He still does. It's happening all the time, apparently.
Yeah.
And let's face it, they're not the only two, or well, one, incestuous
happy
brother.
Happy siblings.
Yes, indeed. We've spoken about one previously in the Strange Family, Strang Family, whatever, in Marabou
Store.
Stick
with Strange.
Yeah, and I know for a fact there's one in the book I mentioned, A Decent Ride. So we have that to look forward to as well. But yeah, Lloyd Boost has not been having sex with his sister, it must be said. But he is
confirmed anyway.
He's starting to get a bit over the hill. I think he's into his 30s, is he?
He is, yeah.
He's still going to raves and taking yokes.
Yeah.
Which is, he's a single man. He can do what he wants, but, you know.
It's his life.
He's starting to feel he'd like something more, I think. But yeah, we're vaguely introduced to some of his friends, Ali, who is kind of advising him that he might want to start looking for true love at this stage. Hazel, who he's basically just having sex with. And there's another girl called Amber who's introduced here, who doesn't do much at all other than, I think, she wants Ali and Ali doesn't want her or something like that.
Yeah, some shite. It's
yeah. But basically, there's a lot of lovey-dovey stuff. This false fucking I love you, mate, and hugging each other.
They're all off their tits and they love each other and then they don't speak to each other for the rest of the week.
But we get alternating chapters between Lloyd and this character of Heather. And I did like the character of Heather. This was another kind of interesting female character, I thought. I just liked the kind of complaining she was doing, stuck in a rut with this dull as fuck husband. I thought some of the writing there for her was good. The husband's called You. She doesn't love, well, does she? No,
she does not love
him. She definitely doesn't love him. And it's just an increasing, you know, it reaches fucking melting point.
Boiling point.
Yeah. One of those with her where she kicks him to the curb, but she does start going clubbing with her friend, and that's how she meets Lloyd for the first time. So obviously they're both fucking eat off the face when they meet anyway, so you couldn't really trust your judgment from the get-go there. But as well as that, Lloyd keeps jumping back to Lloyd's life. We're fully into a Trainspotting style Leet story here.
Except there's nothing funny about it. Well, it's just terrible.
Lloyd knows two women. One's called the victim and one's called the poisonous cunt. I did kind of find that mildly amusing for some reason. He also, I think the Welsh's attempt to show that Lloyd is a good bloke He's also making soup for an old lady that lives downstairs. And like fully on, like going out and buying fresh vegetables and cooking it up. But this isn't, you know, nor a quick soup or whatever. Heather, she's kind of in this crap, excruciating situation with her fella, you. There's one bit which I found interesting where he's kind of licking her parents' arse and they're all over him.
Yeah.
Everyone fucking loves each other except Heather, who really wants to get out. I mean, I'd say there's nothing worse than being with someone who your parents think are great for you.
So I'm sure there's many people who feel in a situation like that.
Oh, he's completely controlling her life and they're actually ganging up on her.
Yeah.
He's agreeing with the parents and vice versa. Lloyd, as well, you mentioned an eyebrow-raising bit here where he's doing a nixer with a fella in a house. And it's more so the other guy, but Lloyd is involved here as well. The other guy is basically rummaging through a fucking teenage girl's knicker drawer.
Having a sniff.
And putting them on his head. Mm. And they get caught now by the father of the house, who, I don't think he throws them out of the fucking gaff even, does he? He just kind of slaps them on the wrist for not doing their work. But whereas this is cause to fucking phone the police, in my eyes. Mm. And Lloyd wasn't exactly, you know, telling your man to stop. He was having a laugh with him about this as well, yeah. Which is kind of disgusting. There is a funny chapter, I have to say, involving Lloyd, where he's off his face on acid. And he's walking down the street and he meets two blokes, they just passing acquaintances, who were on the run from a guy for they haven't paid in the restaurant.
Mm.
And I did think that was good. They get away, but your man, the restaurateur, grabs Lloyd because he thinks he knows them. And there's this kind of confrontation and the cops are involved. And I think your man... Well, Lloyd assaults him, but because bystanders have seen this, they've kind of stuck up for Lloyd when the cops arrived and they just all go on their way. But Lloyd is basically just getting more and more off his tits on acid as this is going on.
I just found every chapter with Lloyd in it just atrocious. There was a bit behind Heather, but Lloyd, God.
No, I thought it was good. The restaurateur kind of, you know, apologizes to Lloyd then for kind of involving him in this and brings him back to the restaurant, which isn't opened yet, and starts making cocktails for Lloyd, who's off his tits on acid. And there's one bit where he just decides he's had enough of hanging around with this bloke and crawls across all the sinks and the dirty dishes and out the window, just falls out the window like a fucking eel and somehow makes his way home. Heather is just totally bored with the husband and kicks him to the curb. She's also got to put up with her boss's sleazy behavior in the workplace. I think I remember that being in the film, now that I mention it. I have watched the film, unfortunately, and we will talk about that.
I have not, as of yet. But
you will. There's a good description, actually, of her taking E for the first time, it has to be said, coming up on it and feeling the love and talking to complete strangers. I do remember that.
Just remember chewing the face off myself.
Well, that as well, definitely. That's definitely one of the main features.
One of the worst features.
Lloyd as well is, he's constantly surrounded by, you know, small-time druggies and dealers. And
lowlifes.
Yeah. He even tries meth at one stage.
What do you mean tries? He's on it the whole time, for fuck's sake.
Just to try and liven up his daily routine.
Yeah, yeah.
So how he has a flat is amazing.
Yeah, it's not a good nick, in fairness.
No, true.
Yeah, how does he earn any money? He's just drug dealing? Or
just small-time drug dealing.
He was running, he was like a mule for the...
He was indeed.
The woman, what's her name? The horrible bitch.
The poisonous cunt.
Poisonous cunt.
So there is a drug mule storyline in here. I think it's exaggerated for the film. I mentioned to you offline that it wasn't in the film, it wasn't in the book, but it is in to some degree. There is a kind of half funny bit where he's nervous. He's agreed to do a DJ slot. He's interested in becoming a bit of a DJ, and he's nervous about it. And the DJ, the rave in question is being held in a fucking community center on a Tuesday afternoon,
2 o'clock.
And this is the character of Woodsy, who is definitely in the film, but has a very small role here in the fucking book. And the vicar is involved here. The vicar is kind of playing along with it because he needs the money from them to rent out the hall. But it goes tits up very quick. As they're setting up the equipment and start playing music, there's still people in the community centre playing table tennis down the other end.
Hard cunts as well.
Yeah.
Which is hard to believe.
They don't like being told to get the fuck out because they're about to start a rave. Old Woodsy starts selling yolks at this rave and there's all sorts, mothers, kids, full families.
Off their tits.
Lloyd does meth that as well, so maybe there is a pattern there.
Yeah.
But the cops arrive and shut up shop fairly early on. Yeah, so Heather has left the husband, Hugh, and is living with her mate. And they go to Ibiza and she's trying to, you know, sow her wild oats and whatnot. But
she struggles.
She really does. Yeah, it sounds like it's a real struggle for her at this stage.
Her previous life is like an anchor. It's holding her back.
Yeah, she's trying to get the husband out of her system and that. But
she's struggling.
There is one final scene where he comes to see her.
And then she definitely gets him out of her system.
She literally roars at him to fuck off. And of course, her mother has taken new side in this, but she doesn't care
about your man, you arrives and he's an absolute twat.
Oh, he is.
Yeah. Oh, fucking hell.
Yeah. No, that's kind of the end of him in this, thank God. Actually, had Lloyd and her met at this stage? Because I have down here, they finally meet.
No.
Okay, so they hadn't met. So this is them finally meeting in the chill-out area. I have down here the chili-out area of a club.
Well, could have been eating chilies.
Where they serve chili con carne to help the old mind from an ecstasy rush.
Just like Rockefellers used to give you curry at the end of the night.
Well, that was the stipulation, wasn't it?
You had to serve food.
I know of only one person who enjoyed those curries.
Well, I know him too.
scrumptious. Heather felt like a giddy schoolgirl, apparently. And this is after her meeting Lloyd and kind of almost instantly falling in love. Somehow falling in love with this scruffy
scrot.
He started washing his clothes and even changing his underwear every day.
And scrubbing under his helmet.
Yes, particularly, yeah.
Yeah, he said he used the pair of white for instance to do them for the full week and then for the Monday to Friday would be one pair and then a pair for the weekend. So this is a type of
Heather.
We all know the sort of person Lloyd is.
Yeah.
Absolute junkie rat. And then suddenly he gets this cracker Heather. Oh God. No, it's just bollocks.
It's possibly a bit unbelievable, all right. Yeah, his mate Nukes, another new character introduced here briefly. Is warning him that it could just be chemically induced love, but Lloyd, of course, doesn't think so. He actually, interestingly, describes the buzz from E and compares it to the adrenaline buzz from swedging.
Violence,
football, hooliganism, which, of course, again, we know from
Violence is a bit better, though. But you can sleep after E, you can't sleep after the fight.
Which sounds like it should be the other way around to me.
Yeah, yeah.
That must be some high. Character Nukes tells him about a girl. This is a little funny section they put in here where he tells the story of a girl that he met and the sex with her was great. They had sex on a lovely scenic location of
Arthur's Seat. They had an instant connection.
Yeah.
They went up to this overlooking of
Arthur's Seat, it's called.
Yeah, and then he lashed her out of it.
Yeah.
And then the same time, Heather's getting the same story from the girl he was with.
Yeah, exactly. So she's obviously telling a kind of horror story version of it where this guy, Nuke says that he just had a sudden come down and then
fucked off.
It just, and obviously your one is telling the other side of that story. But Lloyd, he definitely reassures him that he thinks this is real love and even tells him about the helmet washing, which kind of convinces Nuke, oh Jesus, he must be serious here.
Man hasn't washed his helmet in years.
We get a description of the first time. Sorry, we get Lloyd's description of the first time they have sex, and he describes it as fantastic, and she thinks it is too, he assumes. But the egotistical fucking sap, he thinks that she had such an orgasm that she wasn't accustomed to it, that she started crying.
So imagine thinking that. You were actually that good. That's some fucking... Jeez, whatever drugs he's on, I'll take that.
But he's on meth. And E... graciously gives her time to herself and just goes to her hole. And he just goes off to watch football. So she's sitting there crying and he just heads off to watch
sports night. What was it? Hibs versus fucking
Of course it was.
Dunfermline or something. It's semi-final of the Scull Cup.
And then we get her real recollection of it, and she got upset and frustrated because she came close but didn't actually come. And that's what she was crying about. So she left them because of this and obviously his reaction. But she does go back to him again.
Mm.
The second time is much better for her, for both of them, of course, for him, because he's obviously a sexual dynamo. A bit like old Tambo in The Acid House. Yes.
Well, I can't see how they'd... No. Tambo was an athlete.
Of course,
yes. A well-oiled machine. This is some fucking rat taking drugs every day of his life. He wouldn't even know how to get the fucking thing up, for Jesus' sake.
This is more like old Bob the Fly.
Yeah, this fucking story annoys me.
But yeah... He only wants to see her at the weekend when he's eaten up.
Mm.
And she starts to get pissed off with this and they don't talk.
Crystal meth during the week.
Of course, yes. He likes to unwind, you know, yourself. Suppose, doesn't have a job, so why wouldn't he?
Yeah, true.
But she's pissed off at this, obviously, and they don't talk for a while. And it's at this point that she hears the story about Lloyd being involved in an incestuous relationship with his sister.
Mm.
And of course, she doesn't know at the time that it's not him, it's a different Lloyd. And I actually thought... I thought, being the cynical bastard that I am, that that would have made a better ending for her to just go off thinking that that was him. And we'd have a kind of typical dark Welsh ending. But no, they meet up once more in a club. And his mate Ali puts her straight on the fact that it's not...
He's not a sister fucker.
Yes, it's not him that's involved in that. It's a different Lloyd. And also that on that particular night, he's not intoxicated whatsoever. He's going straight. He's just...
And a couple of drinks.
No drugs. Bit of boogieing and that's it.
And he's off the drugs for a month.
Oh, he's off the meth. He's off everything. Did she even know he was on meth?
No, I don't think she did.
She thought he was on E, which is bad enough. She herself, I think she's off her nut on E.
In fairness,
this occasion.
Meth back in the 90s would have been... Around these places would have been fairly rare.
Well, obviously not in Leith.
Yeah, I suppose. Fucking hell.
Yeah, I don't remember it in Selbridge, all right. I still don't. I've never been offered meth in Selbridge, thank you.
You're not going to the right places.
No, clearly not. But this is enough to win her over in the end, that he's willing to get on the straight and narrow. Mm. And she's looking forward to meeting up with him during the week when they're both completely sober and seeing how that bodes for them. So, yeah, that's the end of that story, James.
It was shite.
It's pretty... It's by far the weakest, I thought, of it.
The weakest? It was fucking shite.
It sounds like a lot of people regard it as the best.
What?
It's the one that was made into the play.
Well, that's maybe because it's the only one that could have been.
Well, yeah. It would have definitely...
It was definitely of its time.
It would have made...
All the drug references with E and all this. At the time, people would have been, yeah, that's great.
Completely, yeah.
Reading it back now, it's just absolute dribble. Absolute fucking dribble.
So, leading on to that, let's do some of your favourite writing.
I don't have any. No, I didn't. I'm not doing any favourite writing for this. It was just terrible.
I have a good bit about Heather. Here we are. 2:14.
She's not that good. She's just good compared to your man.
She is.
You can't
invite me. Yeah, no, I can. So this is Heather. She's kind of going through a...
Menopause.
It does say she's going through a change, but I don't think it's that change. She has an awakening.
A metamorphosis of sorts.
Yeah, it says, the fat started to fall from my body. It started to fall from my brain. Everything was lighter. Fantasizing about getting fucked properly from the start. Then about telling them all to fuck off and die. It was the books that I started reading. It was the music I started listening to. It was the television I started watching. I found myself thinking again. I tried to stop because it was only causing pain. I couldn't. When all this is in your head, it has to come out into your life. If it doesn't, you get crushed. I'm not going to get crushed.
Mm.
I thought that was a good piece of writing from a strong female character.
That was fucking shite. Just melodramatic bollocks.
Okay, I'll just do one more. Oh, yeah. Disturbing. I have it down here for a disturbing piece, a kind of classic Welsh intrusive thought. It's the bit where Lloyd is about to have sex with the poisonous cunt.
Oh, yeah, that was a good bit, actually.
And he's...
fantasizing about fucking her armpits.
Yes.
Because they were hairy.
That's very disturbing, in fairness.
Is it?
each to their own, I guess.
No, it wouldn't be for me now, but like...
There's people out there that would definitely be into that, and there's certainly ladies who prefer not to groom themselves under the arms.
They probably would, but I don't know if they'd like to be poked in the armpit by...
Well, again, some might.
Some might not.
And who are we to judge?
I'm not judging.
But I do have it down here in the disturbing section.
You've judged, not I.
I do, yeah. Anyway, that's our favourite bit of writing. I know we nearly... I didn't see an end in sight with James there for that bit.
No.
And our disturbing bits, which basically amounted to a man wanking about a woman's hairy armpits. Let's now move on to our favourite section, or at least mine, connecting lines. I'm going to leave that one in. Oh, fucking hell. Okay, here we go. Connecting lines. Did you spot anything in this story, James?
Absolutely nothing.
Oh, no, Spud's in this one.
Spud is indeed. And I know you don't want to read any more of this book, but I do. I'm going to just read the chapter because I thought it was quite funny. Chapter?
The full chapter?
Paragraph. Jesus. Paragraph, excuse me. So this is leading up to Lloyd having sex with the poisonous cunt, just after he's been fantasizing about her hairy pits.
Mm.
The chapter. Paragraph goes, when I got there, the front room was mobbed out. In the corner, the victim sat quietly looking out the window, her large black eyes tense and furtive, as if trying to anticipate from where the next shattering blow was going to come to into her life. Bobby was there, displaying a smile that dripped sinister contempt. Monts was there, totally wasted, too wasted to even speak to me. While I picked out Paul Somerville, Jimmy's brother, Brad, Spud Murphy, and some other cunt I vaguely recognised, Solo sat in his wheelchair in the corner. It was a fucking Hammer House of Horrors, right enough. So yeah, Spud was just sitting in this house of horrors. But as well as him, Seeker was mentioned. I don't know if you're familiar with Seeker yet, James, but he's another drug dealer. He brings around some coke for Lloyd.
Mm.
Seeker's mentioned in Trainspotting. He'd be kind of maybe renting second or third choice of drug dealer. And he's definitely mentioned in later. I think he's mentioned in Skag Boys as well. I believe Begbie ends up killing him.
All right, nice chap.
So that's the type of guy we're dealing with here. As Lloyd describes him here, he's a weird cunt, not into any scene, yet every cunt knows him. And as well as that, I suppose, connecting lines as well, as I mentioned at the start, the title of the story is also the name of an Iggy Pop song. The
Mr. Pop.
Mr. Pop. The song is called The Undefeated, and it's actually from the 1990 album Brick by Brick, which also includes the song Neon Forest, which is mentioned in Trainspotting. Iggy Pop, Mr. Pop himself, is actually singing the song at a concert that Tommy is at. And the title of the chapter is Scotland Takes Drugs in Psychic Defense, which is a slight play on what it actually was. America Takes Drugs in Psychic Defense.
That's not affiliated with Nottingham Forest at all.
No, definitely not. And obviously we know that Mr. Pop has a long-standing connection with all things Irvine Welsh. He is.
Pop and Welsh.
They go better than fish and chips. So I think that is it. Thoughts on this story, James?
Dog shite. El Scottery dog shite as well. Not even just dog shite. Terrible, terrible.
Anything
at
all?
If you're reading for the first time, read the first two. And just don't read this.
Then just stop.
It's the worst thing I've ever read from Irvine Welsh. By a long shot. It's atrocious.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
I think it's the most normal of the three stories. And that wouldn't be hard. Because obviously, you know, there's people getting their limbs chainsawed off. Or corpses being interfered with in the other two stories. But I do think it's definitely the weakest. Probably because of this. In a lot of ways.
It's a terrible story.
Well, it is, but we've been built up with these, you know, very strange and unforgettable scenes in the other two stories. And then I suppose he probably intended to end it with a more lovely, normal love story almost. But as I said, I did like the writing of the character of Heather as she was trapped in this relationship with her husband, Hugh. I did think there was some funny bits with Lloyd as well. But I certainly didn't relate to him as a character. I mean, I think Welsh tried to write him as a likeable character. I don't think this came across at all.
No.
But there's just something missing from him for definite. But now it's, you know, I find it easy to understand how it was the story that was made into a film.
Well, he couldn't write the other two.
No, but it's, you know, still, as you say, a very fucking weak storyline to...
Splattery dog shite.
Indeed. So that's that story. Just overall thoughts on the book in general.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Indeed.
As Meatloaf would say, yeah.
Anything else?
No, no, I enjoyed the first two. But then it just... the last one is the longest and it just drags on and it's poor.
Yeah,
it leaves a bad taste, like, because I enjoyed the first two and then, Jesus. I don't know if I'm getting across how much I did not like that last one.
No, I think you are. I think you definitely are. I think there's some heavy shit in this book, but it didn't read as such.
Somehow. No, it's very, it's light, it's quick, and it's funny. Well, it's dark humour, but it is funny.
Yeah.
And then the dribble at the end.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard criticism of the book that it was possibly a rush job because of the popularity and demand for something new from him after Trainspotting and the movie and that. So I don't know how true that is, but yeah, I found the writing style and maybe the fact that it's 3 relatively short novellas that it was just fun to read, or certainly the first two were, but definitely none of them are the strongest stories by Irvine Welsh by a long shot.
If he had his own book on Freddy, it might have been better.
Yeah. Maybe he'll get his own spin-off. I mean, he's still out there.
Freddie and the Marcus of Denbury.
the Earl of Denbury. I don't believe he came up again in another story, but there's definitely still time. But there's definitely some memorable characters and moments, whether funny or disturbing, in this book, which kind of coupled with the, as I say, a really well-written female character in the end, as far as I'm concerned, anyway.
Don't mind that choice. No, if you like Irvine Welsh, you like outrageous stories and dark humour, so you're going to love the first two. Yeah. And then you're going to read the third one, you're going to go, what the fuck is this?
Well, the good news is that we have that story to look into in more depth in movie form.
I can't wait to dive into that particular.
I can't wait to hear.
Is there no mention of the other two at all?
No.
It's just that one.
Just that one, yeah. But it's called Irvine Welsh's Ecstasy, which is, as I say, false advertising, I think. I won't spoil too much about it, but I think I'll enjoy talking about it or slagging it more than I did actually watching it. That's all I'll say. That's coming up on our next episode. Quickly, James, marks out of 5 for Ecstasy.
I'm trying to remember what other marks I gave. I gave 3.5 to Marnaboo. Probably give 3.5 again.
Yeah.
It would have got more only for that pile of shite at the end.
Yeah, you're giving more to me. I'm going to go with 3. Definitely memorable stories, the first two, but still not as strongest storytelling by a long shot. And obviously, as you say, the third story does let it down, certainly. But it's one of his, even though it's one of his most memorable books for me, because it's the first one that came out after I'd become an Irvine Welsh fan, it's not one of his strongest ones by a long shot. So yeah, 3 out of 5. I think we're done here. I think until next time, all I can think of is stay safe out there. Yeah?
Stay safe and rubber up.
And don't have sex with corpses.
No, that's a definite no-no.